You're listening to Culturetopia, the pop culture channel of NPR News. I'm Zoe Chase, producer at the Arts Desk, and this is the week's roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, why do some women in pop music perform in character? NPR's Bob Mondello reviews the Sundance hit crime saga, Animal Kingdom. And we remember two icons of jazz, singer and activist Abby Lincoln and photographer Herman Leonard. But first,
the Metropolitan Museum of Art has a show on that makes the point, clothes make the woman. It features fashion and how it reflects changes in how women look and look at themselves. The exhibition, which runs through this weekend, is called American Woman, Fashioning a National Identity. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg, known for her T-shirts and sturdy shoes, went to see it.
Gowns, dresses, riding habits, a woolen bathing suit, clothes from 1890 to 1940 show the gradual emancipation and rise of the American woman as an international symbol of style and beauty. Mannequins in a 19th-century ballroom, a real gilded cage, are heiresses, dressed to impress in sweeping satin ball gowns, encrusted with sequins and embroidery.
Ladies, what do you think? Is this a prom dress?
Lucy Colgan and her daughter Karen are in from Long Island.
I think you get a lot of attention if you wore that to the prom.
I like the size and the waist.
Well, I think she had some assistance with those.
So.
Remember Scarlett O'Hara, 17
<That's>
inches.
Right.
Most of the ball gowns were made in France. Andrew Bolton, who curated this Met show with clothes from the Brooklyn Museum costume collection, says in the 1890s, Europe showed America how to dress.
It was a huge status for American women to go to France and get their trousseaus and their seasonal wardrobes.
In the late 1890s, women drawn by magazine illustrator Charles Dana Gibson began to challenge the formal, fancy French look. The Gibson girl, with her puffy leg of mutton sleeves and shirtwaists, was slim, youthful, liberated. The first American type.
She was very sporty. She played golf, she played tennis, she'd ride, she'd swim, all in a corset.
The corset started disappearing when another archetypal American woman emerged in the 1910s, Bohemians. No, not Greenwich Villagers. These were millionaire Bohemians married to robber barons. Their path to freedom was art, not sport. Their look, still mostly made in France, was looser, more languid, kimono-ish. And they loved shoes, traveled with cases of them.
I think she was the Imelda Marcos of America.
Yes, indeed.
New Yorker Joyce Mantilla is loving the exhibition.
I mean, the decoration, the lace, to think that this lace was all hand-done. I mean, the nuns were going blind, so let's not get into that. Lace inside, outside, on the bottom, on the top. Bravo. What a world.
10 years later, in the 1920s, the jazz age flapper got the vote, rouged her lips, bobbed her hair, drank bootleg gin, and shimmied the Charleston in a loose chemise.
It's basically just a very flat, tubular shape. Look at the ideal body type. She was tall, she was slim, but she was much more androgynous, flat-chested, no waist and no hips, almost like a skyscraper.
Curator Andrew Bolton says the skyscraper symbolized everything modern, and so did the flapper with her wild, wild ways.
Put the blame on me, boy.
Another decade or two, another new look. It's a Hollywood ending, the screen siren. Hayworth, Harlow, Garbo, Hepburn, glamour girls all in their American-made crepes and lamés, slinky, sexy gowns that shimmered in black and white footage. American movies make a global mark. They shift the fashion gaze from the old world to the new.
I wanted to end with the screen siren because we started in the 1890s with the American woman looking towards Europe for their ideals of style and beauty. And we end the 1930s when really all of Europe was looking towards America for their ideal of beauty, primarily through the screen siren.
Andrew Bolton says attention shifted not so much because of American fashion, but really because of the American woman herself, what she'd come to represent, a physically, sexually liberated, confident human being. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And there's a gallery at our website exhibiting everything from French ball gowns to flapper dresses. It's at NPR.org.
By the way, this month marks a milestone for American women and for the country at large. It was 90 years ago this month that Americans ratified the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. It gave women the right to vote.
In August 1920, the amendment had made it through Congress and most of the states, and then it was up to the state of Tennessee.
The state House of Representatives was deadlocked, and the vote depended on the decision of one man. He was a 24-year-old legislator named Harry Byrne.
He was thought to be opposed to ratification, but on that day in August 1920, he carried a letter from his mother in his pocket.
He later explained his vote by saying, "I know that a mother's advice is always safest for her boy to follow, and my mother wanted me to vote for ratification."
Scoot up the attic, Mammy, and get down Ma's old box of dress patterns.
What you up to with Miss Ellen Portier?
You're going to make me a new dress.
Not with Miss Ellen Portier. Not while I got breath in my body.
Great ball of fire. And my Portier's now. I'm going to Atlanta for that $300, and I've got to go looking like a queen.
One of the most famous scenes in movie history, maybe American history, Scarlett O'Hara is dirt poor after the Civil War, needs to impress Rhett Butler to save Tara, her family plantation, so she rips down her curtain so that Mammy can make her a fabulous dress. But that dress and several others worn by Vivian Leigh in the movie are in bad shape. Seams are loose. The colors have faded. Now the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, Austin, is trying to restore those costumes to their cinema splendor. Steve Wilson is the film curator at the Ransom Center. He joins us from KUT in Austin. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Wilson.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what dresses are we talking about?
The dresses in our collection are the curtain dress, the portier's dress, the red velvet ball gown that Captain Butler throws at her and says, "Here, wear this to Melanie's birthday party."
Oh, yes, of course. Okay.
Yes, it's a good one. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning dress. And the wedding dress that she wears to marry Brett Hamilton.
Yeah.
And we call it the No More Babies dress, where she talks about not wanting to have any more babies. It's a dressing gown.
Mm-hmm.
And the dress that she's wearing when their daughter, Bonnie Blue, has her accident.
Oh, on the horse. Oh, my gosh.
All five are stunning dresses. They're just amazing. But they're just too fragile to display. The curtain dress is the one that we're really concerned about.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, remember that these dresses were only made to last as long as it took to shoot the movie.
Yeah.
The fabric is fine. It's the thread that is deteriorating. Just the weight of the velvet of this dress pulls the seams apart.
As I don't have to tell you, Mr. Wilson, there are a lot of people, when it comes to Gone with the Wind, who, if I might quote Rhett Butler, just don't give a damn.
Sure.
And so why is it important to raise what will be, I'm sure, tens of thousands of dollars to restore these costumes?
Well, there are just as many people who do give a damn about these costumes. And really, there's nothing that captures the human aspect of film like a costume does.
Steve Wilson is the curator for the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
You can see a slideshow of those dresses from Gone with the Wind on our website, NPR.org.
There are a lot of women on the pop charts right now with big, outsized personas. They're so big that it took two series to bring us our next story, The Kitchen Sisters' Hidden World of Girls and NPR Music's Hey Ladies, Women in Music 2010. NPR's Zoe Chace explores why female pop stars are creating these alter egos and why their young fans love them so much.
There are some pop stars right now who look a lot like drag queens.
It's going down, basement, Friday the 13th. Guess who's playing Jason?
That's Lady Gaga, Nicki Minaj, Beyoncé, Katy Perry, and Kesha, all on the charts this year. But don't take it from me. Ask Bibi Zahara-Benet. She's last year's winner of the reality show hosted by maybe the most famous drag queen ever, RuPaul.
Is there anything in particular about these pop stars that reminds Bibi of her colleagues?
You mean everything they wear? That's my answer. Everything they wear on that stage is drag.
It's the wigs, it's the coats, it's the dresses that look like lampshades made of lollipops. It's the velvet stilettos that somehow resemble slinkies.
When you do the art form of drag, you can be whatever or whoever you want to be. So I think that a lot of these female artists have noticed that it's powerful. They can use that as a platform to express themselves, even if that's not who they are in their daily lives.
Beyoncé becomes Sasha Fierce when she performs. Katy Perry puts on a bright blue wig to walk the red carpet. And Stephanie Germanotta, better known as Lady Gaga, wears sunglasses made of cigarettes and sells out stadiums.
I want to create a space for my fans where they can feel free, because I didn't fit in high school and I felt like a freak. So I like to create this atmosphere for my fans where they feel like they have a freak in me to hang out with.
Yeah.
And they don't feel alone.
And it's not just talk show host Ellen's studio audience that gets what Lady Gaga is doing. Catherine Weiss and Sam Mandry are fans outside a Gaga show in St. Louis.
I definitely relate to her because I don't fit in at school either, but her as a person just like helps me get through.
So she's creating this space so people can feel free and be how they want, and it's like we're all crazy because of her, you know.
But when it comes to creating outsized personas, there's someone going toe-to-toe with Lady Gaga.
I'm Nicki Minaj, Nicki Lewinsky, Nicki the Ninja, Nicki the Boss, Nicki the Harajuku Barbie.
Nicki Minaj, Nicki Lewinsky, Nicki the Harajuku Barbie has only released one single and a bunch of mixtapes. But if you listen to pop radio, you can't escape her. It sounds as though she's guesting on every song this summer. What makes Minaj stand out, besides her supply of gaudy little Kim wigs and burlesque outfits, is her endless closet of characters. In one song alone, she's Jamaican, then she's Queens. Not to mention childlike, gangster, valley girl.
I'm sorry, I'm really such a lady. I rep Young Money, you know Slim, baby. And we be doing donuts while we waving. Let's we give a lot of money to the babies out in Haiti.
She ends the song as Roman Zelansky.
When Roman comes out, that's when all the craziness and the voices and the crazy looks and styles start to come out.
22-year-old Brittany Ross loves Nicki Minaj so much, she's adopted Roman Zelansky as her own alter ego.
Sometimes I'm shy, but when Roman or Nicki comes on, that just goes out the window. Like, I don't think about it anymore. I just do it.
At a club outside Chicago called Secrets, where she's been performing as Nicki Minaj for over a year. On Facebook, Ross's name is Brittany Lil B. Zelansky. That's where Nicki Minaj rounds up many of her fans. Just like Lady Gaga, who dubs her followers monsters, Nicki Minaj has built a team by giving her fans a name.
So to all my Harajuku Barbies, step your cookies up, hit me up at twitter.com/Nicki Minaj or myspace.com/Nicki Minaj. Thank you, guys.
Minaj has an army of Barbies on Facebook and Twitter. This generation really gets alter egos. After all, they're constantly deploying different versions of themselves online. One for Facebook, one for Twitter, even one for going out at night. Take 18-year-old Darnell Pert, a Lady Gaga fan in Brooklyn. He created his own persona, Lord Glam.
When I'm Lord Glam, dancing in the club or something, just performing in front of people, it's a different kind of rush. It's a different feeling. And I have more confidence. It's like Beyonce with Sasha Fierce. I kind of relate to her because I kind of know there's two sides.
This is a modern phenomenon, but that doesn't mean it's new. Judith Halberstam teaches media studies at the University of Santa Cruz in California. She says, look back at the 19th century.
People like Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde may well be one of the early people who created a public persona for himself and then was happy when called upon to perform this role of the glib dandy.
Instead of spinning around helplessly in a media cycle devoted to his outlandish behavior, Oscar Wilde grabbed the steering wheel. Halberstam says the British punk band The Sex Pistols did much the same thing in 1976 when they upended a live television show by lobbing expletives at the host.
Dirty f***.
What a clever boy.
What a f***.
Well, that's it for tonight.
It marked a new era in terms of the ways in which performers were going to interact with the supposedly neutral machinery that was just there to capture them.
The artists found the controls for the machine and started feeding it images of their own creation. Glam rocker David Bowie created Ziggy Stardust, an extraterrestrial version of himself. Then there was cross-dressing disco queen Grace Jones. Rapper Lil' Kim showed up on MTV in the 90s, wearing a pink wig and matching stilettos, as if to say, you want sexy? Can you handle this?
I'll be undressed in the bra all see-through. While you count your jewels, thinking I'ma cheat you. The only one thing I wanna do is freak you.
Is this empowering or exploitative? And who's being manipulated? Consider that these stars often have all-male management teams who will push a female singer to be provocative. Today, there are so many platforms to manipulate, and artists need a savvy team to navigate them all, to grab fans and hold them. And the window to make an impression is short. One video is watched by millions all over the world in a matter of minutes. As current pop star Kesha puts it,
I have 3.5 minutes to change somebody's mood, and if I can make them in a better mood, then that's like magic. That's like magic mind control.
So are these stars controlling their fans? Their media coverage? Or just enabling everyone's inner drag queen to come out?
Stroll down the runway, another payday, cover of magazine.
Zoe Chace, NPR News.
From the title Animal Kingdom, you might think the Australian film that opens today in New York and Los Angeles is a nature documentary. Bob Mandela says it is a story about survival of the fittest, just not in the great outdoors.
When we first see 17-year-old Josh Cody, he's sitting with his mom in a suburban Melbourne apartment watching TV. He's absorbed enough in his game show that until the medics arrive, you don't register that his mother isn't breathing. A heroin overdose probably wasn't much of a mom. So it says something that Josh will now go to live with a family she'd spent most of her life trying to protect him from. Uncles for whom even a casual traffic stop with a stranger talking tough from another car.
Hey, you got a stereo? Problem,
man. Prompts an instinctual rush for dominance. Violence is so ingrained with this family that on his first day with them, Josh gets handed a gun and told to act like a predator.
Go get him. And do what? Let him know he's king.
So Josh steps out of the car.
Come on, come outside!
And points the gun.
Hey! Whoa, 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 brother! Just relax, man. I'm just gonna have a chat to him, alright? Just chill, bro. Get out of here, man.
A bit of fun, huh?
Welcome to the jungle, suburban style. White picket fences and beasts of prey. If Josh's uncles are thugs, they're wildly differing thugs. The one egging him on there actually qualifies as their class act. There's another who's forever hopped up on drugs, and one who'd probably be better off if doctors could get his drug mix right. They're all casually lethal, but it's their mom, the queen bee of this brood you shouldn't take your eyes off, a granny who dresses too young, whips up energy shakes as her boys plot crime sprees, and tops them all for sheer cold-bloodedness. She has for decades watched over her children, and no one, not even this new grandchild who's come into her life, can be permitted to endanger them. She makes that clear with an eerie mildness when Josh gets spirited away to a police safe house, and she goes not to a lawyer, but to a corrupt cop.
Tell me if you agree with this. This boy who's being looked after, he knows who you are. And you've done some bad things, sweetie. Haven't you? It shouldn't be too hard to set up a raid on the house. There'd be reasonable grounds, what with all the strange activity, the comings and goings day and night. One of the neighbors might have seen a gun or something. This is your area of expertise. I'm not trying to tell you how to suck eggs. I feel sick about this. I'm not happy at all. Not one little bit. But we do what we have to do. We do what we must.
Actress Jackie Weaver hasn't been heard of much in this country since appearing 35 years ago in Picnic at Hanging Rock, but this part in Animal Kingdom may change that. The film also features Guy Pearce as a low-key detective who tries to help Josh, and newcomer James Freshville as the increasingly endangered teenager. First-time writer-director David Michaud reportedly worked for 8 years on his screenplay, deepening its tale of a violently dysfunctional family until its gangster conventions feel as if they're in the service of a modern-day Greek tragedy. Well, Australian tragedy, though Animal Kingdom, as its title implies, feels pretty universal. I'm Bob Mondello.
Abby Lincoln, the legendary jazz vocalist who believed that singing is a political act, died yesterday at the age of 80 in Manhattan. An actress, artist, and composer, Lincoln's music ranged from avant-garde civil rights era recordings to the equally powerful but more introspective recordings of her later years. NPR's Allison Keyes has this remembrance.
Freedom Day, it's Freedom Day. Throw those shackling chains away.
Abby Lincoln's 1960 collaboration with jazz drummer Max Roach, We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite, put her deep, strong voice smack in the middle of the soundtrack of the movement for civil rights and social change. In one song from that album, Prayer, Protest, Peace, Lincoln literally screams her anger. But that's not how Lincoln started out. Village Voice jazz critic Nat Hentoff supervised the recording of that album and says he watched her metamorphosis from a sultry club singer into a more sophisticated artist.
I saw Abby change, as she later put it to me, as who I really am.
Hentoff says it was magnificent to continue to watch Lincoln find herself as an artist. He also says this sometimes self-deprecating woman with a ready sardonic wit is a huge loss.
You hear who they are as they play. They're telling stories. And so we've lost one of the few still here who was always telling a story.
Then, with disillusion deep in your eyes.
Lincoln's ability to play with the rhythm, phrasing, and vibe of the lyrics made her unique. She was born Anna Marie Wooldridge in Chicago, August 6th of 1930. The 10th of 12 children, Lincoln claimed the living room piano was her private space. After church choirs and an amateur contest, she moved to Los Angeles at 19 to sing in nightclubs. At first, thanks to a manager, Lincoln did the sexy club singer thing. But later, after meeting drummer Max Roach and becoming immersed in the struggles of black people around the world, Lincoln got a reputation for being what she called a warrior. In the 1968 movie, For the Love of Ivy, she plays an unconventional maid with a mind of her own.
What more you want?
I don't want to get married.
Did I say you did?
It always did the actresses in because I was the one who was supposed to have this reputation as a freedom fighter and everything, mm-hmm. and I got two movies.
Lincoln played opposite Sidney Poitier and told NPR the film's producers thought she would be more subdued. She wasn't.
Oh, the holy earth's mural, seen from way up high.
Lincoln continued her maverick career, writing music with images so sharp it sometimes seemed they cut you. Chicago jazz singer Maggie Brown collaborated with Lincoln on the 1999 album Holy Earth and says Lincoln was an intense performer and person who was very secure in who she was.
She was committed to her art. She seemed very clear that of what her purpose was, what she was to do.
And Brown says Lincoln didn't care what value others put on her work.
She was really, as the young people say, doing her.
Lincoln once said, when people leave this earth, they spread their wings of miracles in a blaze of light and disappear. But luckily, her spirit lives on in her recordings. Allison Keyes, NPR News.
Photographer Herman Leonard died in a Los Angeles hospital on Saturday, according to his official website. He was 87 years old. Leonard's black-and-white photographs of jazz musicians are considered as artful and expressive as the music they chronicled. But as NPR's Felix Contreras reports, the negatives sat out of view for decades under Leonard's bed.
Herman Leonard's life was an example of the phrase, everything in its time. Shortly after earning a fine arts degree in photography in the late 1940s, Leonard was making a living in New York as a commercial photographer during the day and hanging out in jazz clubs at night. Herman Leonard focused his camera lens on young musicians who would go on to become jazz legends: Billie Holiday, Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis, to name just a few.
You could look at his photos and almost hear the music.
John Hassey is the curator of American music at the Smithsonian's Museum of American History.
He used light, shadow, and smoke, and he made indelible the faces of many of the greatest American musicians of the 20th century.
While many of his subjects became good friends, only a few of his photos were used on album covers, and he gave many away to jazz clubs for promotional purposes. Mostly, the negatives sat in boxes. Meanwhile, Leonard's career took him to Paris, where he worked as a fashion and commercial photographer for almost 3 decades. After taking a break from photography, the Leonard family landed in London. His daughter, Shauna Leonard, remembers it being a tough time.
Well, he was in his 60s at this point. I can't imagine when you're in your 60s and you have no money and your family's broken up. And, he was pretty lost at that point.
For direction, Herman Leonard returned to those early jazz negatives.
I would very comfortably say that these jazz negatives saved his life.
He published his first book of photographs in 1985, more than 3 decades after he made the images.
If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean.
After being turned down by the major London galleries, Leonard's first exhibit took place in 1988 in a small space where over 10,000 people visited the show in the first month. What those people saw was what Herman Leonard saw through his viewfinder sitting in the front row of jazz clubs so many years before, as he explained in a 2007 interview with NPR.
Well, that's where I could hear the music, and that's where it happened. It happens in the clubs. It doesn't happen in a photo studio. And I wanted to record image-wise, to make a visual diary, if you wish, of what I was experiencing.
Herman Leonard's photography is exhibited in galleries around the world. His images have been reproduced in jazz books and magazines, and 155 of his prints are in the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. They share space there with many jazz items, including his old friend Dizzy Gillespie's trumpet. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories you heard today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Zoe Chace. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Culturetopia.